never address us, I spoke to him. Professor Stoichev, please forgive this invasion of your solitude. We are very grateful to you and to your niece for letting us visit you. Stoichev looked at his hands on the table and then at me. His eyes, with their combined mildness and wariness, had something of the animal in them. His teeth were yellow and crooked, and one of them, in the front, was covered in gold. He smiled now with such force that it made Helen and me smile, too. Irina beamed at us. She had settled herself in a chair under an icon of someone, I assumed it was St. George, putting his spear with vigor through an undernourished dragon.
"I'm very glad that you have come to see me. I'm very glad to be able to practice my English with you, although it is not as good as it was, I'm afraid."
"Your English is excellent. Where did you learn it, if you don't mind my asking?"
"Oh, I do not mind. I had the good fortune to study abroad when I was young, and some of my studies were conducted in London. Is there anything with which I can help you, or did you only wish to visit my library?"
"Both. We wish to visit it, and we wish to ask you some questions for our research." I paused to hunt for words. "Miss Rossi and I are very much interested in the history of your country in the Middle Ages, although I know far less about it than I ought to, and we've been writing some, I began to falter, because what we had to discuss was highly personal, terribly improbable, and not at all something that I wanted to broach with Ranoff sneering down at the table.
"So, you are interested in the medieval Bulgaria?"
It seemed to me that he, too, glanced in Ranoff's direction. Helen came quickly to my rescue.
"Yes, we are interested in the monastic life of medieval Bulgaria, and we have been researching it as well as we can for some articles we would like to produce. Specifically, we would like to know about life in the monasteries of Bulgaria in the late medieval period, and about some of the routes that brought pilgrims to Bulgaria, and also routes by which pilgrims from Bulgaria traveled to other lands."
Stoichev lit up, shaking his head with apparent pleasure so that his large, delicate ears caught the light.
"That is a very good topic. Is there something in particular you will write about? I have many manuscripts here that might be useful to you, and I would be happy to permit you to look at them if you would like."
Ranoff shifted in his chair, and I thought again how much I disliked his watching us. Fortunately, most of his attention seemed to be focused on Irina's pretty profile across the room. "Well, we'd like to learn more about the 15th century, the late 15th century, and Dr. Rossi here has done quite a bit of work on that period in her family's native country, that is."
"Romania, but I was raised and educated in Hungary."
"What brings you to Bulgaria?"
"Miss Rossi and I became interested in doing some research on connections between Bulgaria and the Orthodox community in Istanbul after the Ottoman conquest of the city. We've been writing some articles about it. We would like very much to finish our research here in Bulgaria, and we thought you might well be able to help us."
"Of course. Perhaps you could tell me exactly what interests you most about the history of our medieval monasteries and the routes of pilgrimages, and about the 15th century in particular."
There was no help for it. We would have to talk about some aspect of our search with Ranoff sitting right there. After all, if I asked him to leave, he would immediately become suspicious about our purpose here. Our only hope was to make our questions sound as scholarly and impersonal as possible. "We believe there are some interesting connections between the Orthodox community in 15th century Istanbul and the monasteries of Bulgaria."
"Yes, of course, that is true, especially since the Bulgarian church was placed by Mehmed the Conqueror under the jurisdiction of the Patriarch of Constantinople. Before that, of course, our church was independent with its own patriarch in Veliko Turnovo."
I felt a wave of gratitude toward this man with his erudition and wonderful ears. My comments had been close to inane, and yet he was answering them with circumspect, not to mention informative politeness. "Exactly. And we're especially interested. We found a letter, that is. We were recently in Istanbul ourselves." I was careful not to glance at Ranoff. "And we found a letter that has to do with Bulgaria, with a group of monks who traveled from Constantinople to a monastery in Bulgaria. We're interested, for the purposes of one of our articles, in tracing their route through Bulgaria. Perhaps they were on pilgrimage. We're not quite sure." Stoichev's eyes were warier and more luminous than ever.
"I see. Can you tell me a little about its contents, or who wrote it, if you know that?"
"Certainly. In fact, we have a copy of it here." I opened my briefcase and got the copy out, handing it to him, hoping Ranoff would not ask for it next. Stoichev took the letter, and I saw his eyes flash over the opening lines.
Interesting.
To my disappointment, he set it down on the table. Perhaps he was not going to help us after all, or even read the letter. He turned to his niece.
My dear, I don't think we can look at odd letters without offering these guests something to eat and drink. Would you bring us rakia and a little lunch?
He nodded with particular politeness toward Ranoff. Irina rose promptly, smiling, and she spoke in beautiful English. There was no end, I thought, to the surprises in this household.
Certainly, uncle, but I would like some help to bring it up the stairs.
I will be glad to help the young lady.
And they went downstairs together, Ranoff thumping noisily on the steps and Irina chattering to him in Bulgarian. As soon as the door closed behind them, Stoichev leaned forward and read the letter with greedy concentration. When he was done, he looked up at us. His face had lost 10 years, but it was tense, too.
This is remarkable.
Yes, what? Do you have any sense of what it might mean? Stoichev's eyes were enormous, and he looked intently at me.
A little. You see, I, too, have one of Brother Kirill's letters.
I remembered all too well the bus station in Perpignan, where I had stood with my father the year before, waiting for a dusty bus to the villages. The bus pulled up again now, and Barley and I boarded it. The hotel in Les Bains was much as I remembered it, too, with its 4 stories of stucco, its iron window grills, and boxes of rosy flowers. I found myself longing for my father, breathless with the thought that we'd see him soon, perhaps in a few minutes. For once I led Barley, pushing the heavy door open and putting my bag down in front of the marble-topped desk inside. But then that desk seemed so extremely high and dignified that I felt shy again, and had to force myself to tell the sleek old man behind it that I thought my father might be staying here. I didn't remember the old man from our visit here, but he was patient, and after a minute said there was indeed a foreign monsieur by that name staying there, but La Clé, his key, was not in, and therefore he himself must be out. He showed us the empty hook. My heart leapt. I asked where my father was, if anybody knew, but no one did. He had left early, the old man contributed, perhaps to take a morning walk. Why didn't we go up to my father's room and leave our bags, at least? My father had taken a suite with a nice view and a little parlor to sit in. My father's room was spacious and pleasant, and I would have enjoyed every nook of it if I hadn't felt uncomfortably that I was invading his sanctuary for the 3rd time in a week. Worse was the sudden sight of my father's suitcase, his familiar clothes around the room, his battered leather shaving kit, and good shoes. Their familiarity hit me hard. But even this was eclipsed by another shock. My father was by nature an orderly man. Any room or office he inhabited, however briefly, was a model of neatness and discretion. Never before had I seen my father's possessions in rank disorder. His suitcase sat half unpacked by the bed. He had apparently rummaged through it and pulled out 1 or 2 items, leaving a trail of socks and undershirts on the floor. His light canvas coat sprawled across the bed. He had clearly been in the greatest hurry of his life.
When Stoichev told us he had one of Brother Kirill's letters, Helen and I looked at each other in amazement.
What do you mean?
Stoichev tapped Turgut's copy with excited fingers.
A manuscript was given to me in 1924 by my friend Atanas Angelov. It describes a different part of the same journey, I am certain. I did not know that any other documents from these travels were in existence. Wait.
He rose and went into one of the smaller rooms, gesturing for us to follow. There he scanned the shelves and then reached for a box which I helped him take down. From it he pulled a cardboard file tied with fraying cord. He brought this back to the table and opened it under our eager eyes, drawing out a document so fragile that I shuddered to watch him handling it. He stood looking at it for a long minute, as if paralyzed, and then sighed.
This is the original, as you can see. The signature.
We bent over it, and there, with a rush of goose flesh over my arms and neck, I saw an exquisitely penned Cyrillic name that even I could read. Kirill. And the year. 6985. I looked at Helen and she bit her lip. The faded name of this monk was terribly real. So was the fact that he had once been as alive as we were, had set a quill to this parchment with a warm, living hand. Stoichev looked almost as odd as I felt, although the sight of such an old manuscript must have been his daily fare.
I have translated it into Bulgarian.
After a moment, he drew out another sheet. This one typed onion skin. We sat down.
I will try to read it to you.
He cleared his throat and gave us a rough but competent version of a letter that has since been widely translated.
Your Excellency, Lord Abbot Eupraxius, I take my pen in hand to fulfill the task you have in your wisdom put upon me, and to tell you the particulars of our mission as we come to them. May I do justice to them and to your wishes, with God's assistance. We sleep this night near Virbius, 2 days' journey from you, at the monastery of St. Vladimir, where the Holy Brothers have welcomed us in your name. As you have instructed, I went alone to the Lord Abbot and told him our mission in the greatest secrecy, with not even a novice or a servant present. He has commanded our wagon to remain under lock in the stables within the courtyard, with 2 guards from among his monks and 2 from among our number. I hope we may meet often with such understanding and safekeeping, at least until we cross into the infidel lands. As you have instructed, I placed 1 book in the Lord Abbot's hands with your injunctions, and saw that he hid it forthwith, not even opening it before me. I am yours most humbly, in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, Brother Kirill, April, the year of our Lord, 6985.
I think Helen and I hardly breathed as Stoichev read this aloud. I was just about to exclaim aloud over the indubitable connection between the 2 letters, when a thud of feet on the wooden stairs below made us all look up.
They are coming back.
He put the letter away and I placed ours with it for the time being in his safe keeping.
Mr. Ranov, he was assigned to you as your guide?
Yes, and he seems far too interested in our work here. There is a lot more we must tell you about our research, but it's rather private, and also... I paused.
Dangerous?
Irina and Ranov came into the sitting room with a clash of plates, and Irina began setting out glasses and a bottle of amber liquid.
Please, honored guests, make yourselves welcome.
Stoichev waved a hand over the table as if it belonged to the Emperor of Constantinople. Irina poured glasses of brandy. The smell alone could have killed a small animal. And he toasted us gallantly, his yellow-toothed smile wide and genuine.
I drink to friendship among scholars everywhere.
We all returned this toast with enthusiasm, except for Ranov, who raised his glass ironically and looked around at us.
May your scholarship advance the knowledge of the party and the people.
Ranov gave me a little bow. This almost took the edge off my appetite.
I am glad to have the chance to talk with anyone who is interested in our medieval history. Perhaps it would be interesting for you and Miss Rossi to see a holiday that celebrates 2 of our great medieval figures. Tomorrow is the day of Kirill and Methodi, creators of the great Slavonic alphabet. In English, you would say Cyril and Methodius. You call it Cyrillic, do you not? We say Kirillitsa for Kirill, the monk who invented it.
For a moment, I was confused, thinking of our brother Kirill, but when Stoichev spoke again, I saw what he had in mind and how resourceful he was.
I am very busy with my writing this afternoon, but if you would like to come back tomorrow, some of my former students will be here to celebrate the day, and I can tell you more about Kirill then.
That is extremely kind of you. We do not want to use too much of your time, but we would be honored to join you. Can that be arranged, Comrade Ranov?
The comrade did not seem to be lost on Ranov, who scowled at her over his 2nd glass of brandy.
Certainly. If this is how you would like to accomplish your research, I am happy to be of assistance.
Very good. We will gather here about 1:30, and Irina will have something nice for our lunch.
We thanked him profusely and obeyed Irina's urging to eat. It wasn't until evening that we had a few minutes alone together. Helen and I strolled out to a cafe on a side street near the hotel and sat under the trees. We seated ourselves at a metal table.
Someone is watching us here also. But at least this is not bugged like my room. And yours.
She looked up into the green branches above us. I took her hand and turned it over so that I could see her palm with its graceful lines. I hoped they meant she would have a long life and good fortune, both shared by me. What do you make of Stoichev's having that letter?
It might be a stroke of luck for us.
Yes. We will have to wait until tomorrow to find out what he meant. She laced her fingers through mine.
It is agonizing for you to wait every day, isn't it?
I nodded slowly. If you knew Rossi... I stopped. Her eyes were fixed on mine, and she slowly brushed back a lock of hair that had slipped out of its pins. The gesture was so sad that it gave full weight to her next words.
I do begin to know him, through you.
At that moment, a waitress in a white blouse came out to us and asked something. She looked curiously at us, creatures who spoke a foreign language. Helen turned to me.
What to drink?
What do you know how to order? I teased Helen. She pointed at herself and me.
Chai. A tea, please. Molya.
You're learning fast. Helen shrugged.
I've studied some Russian. Bulgarian is very close.
When the waitress had returned with our tea, Helen stirred it with a somber face.
It is such a relief to get away from Ranov.
If I knew whether he actually suspects anything about our search, I'd feel better. The strange thing is, he reminds me of someone I've met before, but I seem to have amnesia about who that is. I glanced at Helen's serious, lovely face. And in that second, I felt my brain groping for something, fluttering on the edge of some puzzle, and it wasn't the question of Ranov's possible twin. Amnesia. Helen. Helen, amnesia.
What?
She frowned at my intensity, puzzled. Rossi's letters! I almost shouted. I pulled open my briefcase so hastily that our tea slopped onto the table. His letter, his trip to Greece! It took me several minutes to find the damn thing among my papers, and then to trace the passage, and then to read it aloud to Helen, whose eyes widened slowly to a shocked darkness. You remember the letter about how he went back to Greece, to Crete, after having his map taken away from him in Istanbul, and how his luck changed to bad and everything went wrong? I rattled the page in front of her. Listen to this. The old men in Crete's tavernas seemed much more inclined to tell me their 210 vampire stories than they were to explain where I might find other shards of pottery like that one. One evening I let a stranger buy me a round of a local specialty called, whimsically, amnesia, with the result that I was sick all the next day.
Oh, my God.
I let a stranger buy me a drink called amnesia. I paraphrased, trying to keep my voice down. Who the hell do you think that stranger was? And that's why Rossi forgot. Helen seemed hypnotized by the word.
He forgot. He forgot Romania. He forgot my mother.
We arrived at Stoichev's gate the next day promptly at 1:30. Helen squeezed my hand, ignoring Ranov's presence, and even Ranov seemed in a festive mood. From behind the gate, we could hear the sounds of conversation and laughter and smell wood smoke and some delicious meat cooking. Inside the yard, we could see groups of men and a few women gathered under the trellis. Arina flitted here and there behind the table, refilling people's plates. When she saw us, she hurried forward, arms outstretched as if we were already old friends. She shook hands with me and Ranov and kissed Helen on the cheeks.
I'm very happy that you came.
We found Stoichev holding court under the apple trees. Someone had set a ring of wooden chairs there, and he sat in the largest with several younger men around him. He struggled to his feet.
Oh, hello. These are some of my students from before the war, and they are so kind to come back and see me.
Arina came up behind us. She seemed to be urging everyone to eat once again, for after a minute we found ourselves carried along by a wave of guests to the tables under the trellis. Arina left us no peace until our plates were almost too heavy to carry, and she followed us back into the little orchard bearing glasses of rakia.
When the company settled again to eating and talking, Helen and I found ourselves in places of honor next to Stoichev. He smiled and nodded to us.
Come, let us talk while we are able to. My niece has promised to keep Mr. Ranov busy as long as she can. I have a few things to tell you, and I understand you have much to tell me as well.
Certainly. I pulled my chair closer to his, and Helen did the same.
First of all, my friends, I read again carefully the letter you left with me yesterday. Here is your copy of it.
He took it from his breast pocket.
I will give it to you now to keep it safe. I read it many times, and I believe that it was written by the same hand that wrote the letter I possess. Brother Kirill, whoever he was, wrote both of them. Now I have some other thoughts for you. But first you must tell me more about your research. I have the impression that you did not come to Bulgaria to learn only about our monasteries. How did you find this letter?
I told him that we'd begun our research for reasons that would be difficult for me to describe, because they did not sound very rational. As quickly and clearly as I could, I sketched for Stoichev my discovery of the Dragon Book, Rossi's disappearance, the contents of the letters and the copies of the strange maps we carried with us, and our research in Istanbul and Budapest, including the folk song in the woodcut with the word Ivirianu in it, which we'd seen in the university library in Budapest. He listened with the utmost patience and interest, his brow furrowed under his fine white hair. But the point that seemed to pique his interest even more was Turgut and Selim's discovery that the abbot to whom Brother Kirill's letters were addressed had presided over the monastery at Snagov in Wallachia.
Snagov?
His old face had flushed crimson, and I wondered for a moment if he was going to faint.
I should have known this. I have had that letter in my library for 30 years. And this word, Ivirianu, that you found.
Do you know what it means? Stoichev seemed to be looking through me without seeing.
Yes, yes, my son. It is the name of Anthim Ivirianu, a scholar and printer at Snagov at the end of the 17th century, long after Vlad Tsepes. His press was the first one in Romania, in all probability. But, my God, perhaps it was not the first, if the Dragon books are much older. There is a great deal I must show you. Let us go into my rooms quickly.
He shook his head wide-eyed. Helen and I glanced around. Ranov is busy with Irina. Stoichev struggled up the stairs and we went slowly after him. At the big table he sat down to rest. I noticed it was scattered with books and manuscripts that hadn't been there the day before. Stoichev caught his breath.
I have never had very much information about that letter, or the others.
The others?
Helen sat down beside him.
Yes. There are two more letters from Brother Kirill. With mine and the one in Istanbul, that is four. We must go to Rila Monastery immediately to see the others. This is an incredible discovery to reunite them. But that is not what I must show you. I never made any connection.
Again he seemed too stunned to speak for long. After a moment, he went into one of the other rooms and came back carrying a paper-covered volume, which proved to be an old scholarly journal printed in German.
I had a friend, I told you. His name was Atanas Angelov. Yes, he was a Bulgarian historian and one of my first teachers. In 1923, he was doing some researches in the library at Rila, which is one of our great treasure houses of medieval documents. He found there a manuscript from the 15th century. It is the chronicle of a journey from Wallachia to Bulgaria. He died while he was making notes on it, and I finished them and published it.
He opened the faded journal with a hand that trembled, and his voice trembled too as he translated from the article.
The tale of Stefan of Snagov, faithfully transcribed by Zacharias the Sinner. I, Stefan, after years of wandering, and also after the loss of the beloved and holy city of my birth, Constantinople, went in search of rest north of the great river that divides the Bulgarians from Tesha. At length, I found my way to the monastery that sits on the island in Lake Snagov, a most beautifully secluded and defensible place. There the good abbot welcomed me, and I took my seat at table with monks as humble and dedicated to prayer as any I had met in all my journeys. This church and the monastery had received the utmost assistance and fortification from the prince of that region, Vlad, son of Vlad Dragul, who was thrice chased from his throne by the Sultan and other enemies. In the last year of his life, Dracula came to the monastery, as he had been wont to do more often in earlier times. I did not see him then, because the abbot had sent me and one other monk on an errand to another church, where he had some business. When I returned, I heard that the Lord Dracula had been there, and had left new treasures. Perhaps 4 months later there came word that he had been surrounded in a battle, and there caught and slain by the infidel soldiers. Upon his death, the Sultan's soldiers cut off his head and took it away with them to show their master. All this was known by the men of Prince Dracula's camp, and although many hid away after his death, some of them brought this news and also his body to the monastery of Snagov, after which they also fled. The abbot wept when he saw the body lifted from the boat and prayed aloud for the Lord Dracula's soul. He caused the body to be laid in state in the church. It was one of the most dreadful sights I have seen, this headless corpse robed in red and purple and surrounded by many flickering candle flames. We sat in watches in the church, keeping the holy vigil for another 3 days and nights. On the third night, some of the tired brothers dozed, and something occurred to strike terror into the hearts of the others. What it was, they could not later agree, each having seen something different. One monk saw an animal leap from the shadows of the stalls and over the coffin, but could not ascertain what shape the animal had. Others felt a gust of wind or saw a thick fog enter the church, which gathered many of the candles, and they swore by the saints and angels, and especially the archangels Michael and Gabriel, that in the dark the headless body of the prince stirred and tried to rise. The monks, running out, related their visions with bitter disagreement among them. The abbot came forward, and I saw in the light of the torch he held that he grew very pale, and awed at the stories they related, crossing himself many times. The next evening he called 8 monks together, honoring me by inclusion among them, and said that we would only make a pretense of burying the prince's body in the church, but that it must instead be conveyed at once from this place. In this way, I, who had thought never to wander again, became a traveler once more and crossed a long distance, entering with my companions the city of my birth, which had become the seat of the infidel's kingdom. And there I learned that we were looking for a treasure that might hasten the salvation of the soul of this prince, and that this treasure had already been procured at great risk by 2 holy and brave monks from the monastery of Saint Savior, and taken secretly out of the city. We were forced to wander once more to find it, this time traveling into the old kingdom of the Bulgars. We traveled to the monastery of Sveti Georgi. There the monks, although they were old and few, welcomed us and told us that indeed the treasure we sought had been brought to them by 2 pilgrims some months previous to this, and all was well. The relics we had conveyed thither were secretly enshrined at Sveti Georgi. For some time we lived in peace at this place, and the monastery was built up greatly by our labors. Soon, however, a plague broke out in the villages near us, although at first it did not infect the monastery. Then I learned that this was no ordinary plague, but instead... At this point, the manuscript is cut, or torn off.
Stoichev laid the article down. Helen and I sat mute for a couple of minutes. Stoichev himself shook his head now and then, drawing one hand over his face as if to wake himself from a dream. At last Helen spoke.
It is the same journey. It must be the same journey.
I believe it is. And surely Brother Kirill's monks were transporting the remains of Vlad Tsepesh.
And this means that they reached a Bulgarian monastery safely. Sveti Georgi. Where is it?
It was the question I had most wanted to ask myself, out of all the puzzles that pressed on me. Stoichev put his hand to his brow.
If I only knew. No one knows. Sveti Georgi is one of several medieval monasteries in Bulgaria that we know existed, but which vanished during the early centuries of the Ottoman yoke. After my friend Angelov died, I tried for a while to continue his research. I went to Bachkovsky Monastir, and I talked with the monks and asked many people in the region, but no one knew of a monastery called Sveti Georgi. I wanted to go to Snagov before the war to see what I could learn there.
If you had, you might have met Rossi. Stoichev smiled strangely.
Perhaps. If Rossi and I had indeed met there, perhaps we could have joined our knowledge then, before it was too late. You see, I stopped my research rather suddenly. The day when I returned from the Bachkova region, with my mind full of a plan to go to Romania, I came back to find an awful scene.
He paused again and closed his eyes.
I tried not to think about that day. I saw that someone had gone through all my things, pulled books off the shelves and searched my closet. On the desk, all over my papers, was a small trail of blood. You know how ink stains a page.
He broke off, looking piercingly at us now.
In the middle of the desk, there lay a book I had never seen before.
Suddenly he rose and shuffled into the other room again, and we heard him moving around, shifting books. I should have gotten up to help him, but I sat instead staring helplessly at Helen, who seemed frozen too. After a moment, Stoichev returned with a large folio in his arms. It was bound in worn leather. He laid it in front of us, and we watched as he opened it with his reluctant old hands and showed us, wordlessly, the many blank pages, the great image in the center. The dragon looked smaller here, because the larger pages of the folio left considerable empty space around it, but it was certainly the same woodcut.
It is the only project I have not continued. I might have gone on, even then, except for this.
He turned slowly to the second leaf of the folio.
This.
There on the page we saw a single word written in a beautiful archaic hand in the ancient mellowed ink. I knew just enough by now of Kirill's famous alphabet to puzzle it out, although the first letter stumped me for a second. Helen read it aloud.
Stoichev. Oh, you found your own name in it. How terrible.
Yes, my own name, and in a handwriting and an ink that were clearly medieval. I have always regretted that I was a coward about this project. But I was afraid. I thought that something might happen to me. Like what happened to your father, madam.
You feared with good reason, but perhaps it's not too late for Professor Rossi. He straightened in his chair.
Yes. If we can somehow find Sveti Georgi. First, we must go to Rila Monastery and look at the other letters by Brother Kirill. As I said, I never before connected them with the tale of Stefan. I do not have copies of them here, and the authorities at Rila have not allowed them to be published, although several historians, including myself, have requested permission. And there is someone at Rila with whom I would like you to talk. He may not be of any assistance, however.
Stoichev looked as if he had something else to say, but at that moment we heard vigorous footsteps on the stairs. He tried to rise, then shot me a pleading look. I snatched up the dragon folio and plunged into the next room with it, where I hid it as well as I could behind a box. I rejoined Stoichev and Helen in time to see Ranoff open the door to the library.
Ah, a conference of historians. You are missing your own party, Professor.
He browsed unabashedly through the books and papers on the table, and at last picked up the old journal from which Stoichev had read us parts of the tale of Stefan.
It would be most helpful for the research of these visitors if you would arrange for them to travel to Rila Monastery. I would like to travel with them also, and it will be an honor for me to show them the library of Rila myself.
Ranoff weighed the journal in his hand.
Rila? Very well. We will make that our next excursion.
No, my friends. This has been a pleasant exchange of ideas, but Kirill and Metodi will not mind if we also eat, drink, and be merry, as they say. Come, Miss Rossi.
He extended his fragile hand to Helen, who helped him up.
Give me your arm, and we will go to celebrate a day of teaching and learning.
My first glimpse of Rila Monastery filled me with awe. The monastery sat in a dramatically deep valley, and above its walls and domes rose the Rila Mountains. Vranov had parked his car in the shade outside the main gate, and we made our way in with several clumps of other tourists. The great wooden doors of the gate were open, and we went through them into a sight I can never forget. Around us loomed the walls of the monastery fortress, with their alternating patterns of black and red on white plaster, hung with long wooden galleries. Filling a third of the enormous courtyard was a church of exquisite proportions, its porch heavily frescoed, its pale green domes alight in the midday sun. Helen, standing next to me with a thin scarf tied over her hair, put her arm through mine. Stoichev, beside us, was clearly enjoying our astonishment. Irina, in a broad-brimmed hat, held his arm tightly. Only Ranov stood alone, scowling at the beautiful scene, turning his head suspiciously when a group of black-cowled monks passed us on their way into the church.
"This is the wing where the monks still live. And over there, along that side, is the hostel where we will sleep. You will see how peaceful it is here at night, in spite of all the visitors in the day. Come. We will go in to see the abbot. I called him yesterday, and he is expecting us."
He led the way with surprising vigor, looking eagerly around, as if the place gave him new life. The abbot's audience chambers were on the first floor of the monastic wing. A black-gowned monk with a long brown beard held the door for us, and we went in, Stoichev removing his hat and entering first. The abbot rose from a bench near the wall and came forward to meet us. He and Stoichev greeted each other very cordially, Stoichev kissing his hand and the abbot blessing the old man. The abbot shook hands with us in a very modern way and with Ranov, who greeted him with obvious disdain. The abbot was clearly delighted to see Stoichev there, and I imagine the visit must be a particular pleasure to both of them. He asked us through Stoichev where we were from in America, whether we had visited other monasteries in Bulgaria, what he could do to help us, how long we would be able to stay. Stoichev spoke with him at length, translating obligingly so that we could answer the abbot's questions. "We could use the library as much as we liked," the abbot said. "We could sleep in the hostel. We should attend the services in the church." We thanked him gratefully, and Stoichev got to his feet.
"Now, since we have these kind permissions, we will go to the library."
He was already making his way cautiously to the door, kissing the abbot's hand, bowing. The library was a long gallery on the first floor, nearly opposite the abbot's room. At the entrance, a black-bearded monk ushered us in. He was a tall, gaunt-faced man, and it seemed to me that he looked hard at Stoichev for a moment before nodding to us.
"This is Brother Rumen. He is the librarian monk at present. He will show us what we need to see."
Stoichev spoke with the librarian, who began to look carefully through labeled boxes on the shelves. After a few minutes, he brought down a wooden box and took from it a volume, which had the look of old bone. The librarian carried it to a table, and Stoichev sat eagerly down to it, opening it with relish. Helen and I drew out our notebooks, and Ranov strolled around the library shelves as if too bored to stay in one place.
"As I remember, there are two letters here, and it is unclear whether Brother Kirill wrote others that have not survived."
He pointed to the first page. It was covered in a close, rounded, calligraphic hand, and the parchment was deeply aged, almost brown. Stoichev sat silent a while, examining the pages of ancient calligraphy. Finally, he read to us a halting version of the two letters.
"Your Excellency, Lord Abbot Eupraxius, we are now 3 days upon the high road journeying out of Lauda toward Wien. Tonight we are made welcome in the house of a shepherd of some wealth, and also of piety. He has 3,000 sheep in this region, he tells us, and we are bid sleep on his soft sheepskins and mattresses, although I, for one, have elected the floor as more fitting to our devotions. We are out of the forest here, among open hills that roll on every side, where we may walk with equal blessing in rain and sunshine. The good man of the house tells us they have twice suffered the raids of the infidel from across the river, which is now a few days' walk only. Fortunately, we have seen no signs of infidel soldiers on the road. Your most humble servant in Christ, Brother Kirill, April, the year of our Lord, 6985. Your Excellency, Lord Abbot Eupraxius, we have left the city some weeks behind us and are now riding openly in the territory of the infidels. I dare not write our location in case we should be captured. Perhaps we should have chosen the sea route after all, but God will be our protector along the way we have chosen. We have seen the burned remains of two monasteries in one church. The church was smoking as yet. Five monks were hung there for conspiring to a rebellion, and their surviving brothers are scattered to other monasteries already. This is the only news we have learned, as we cannot talk long with the people who come out to our wagon. There is no reason to think one of these monasteries is the one we seek, however. The sign will be clear there. The monster equal to the saint. If this missive can be delivered to you, my lord, it shall be as soon as possible. Your humble servant in Christ, Brother Kirill, June, this year of our Lord, 6985.
When Stoichev had finished, we sat in silence. There was no clear evidence here of a particular destination, no mention of a tomb, no scene of burial. The disappointment I felt was choking, but Stoichev seemed far from downcast.
Interesting. Interesting. You see, your letter from Istanbul must lie between these two letters here chronologically. In the first and second letters, they are traveling through Wallachia toward the Danube. That is clear from the place names. Then comes your letter, which Brother Kirill wrote in Constantinople, perhaps hoping to send it and the previous letters from there. But he was unable or afraid to send them, unless these are just copies. We have no way to know. And the last letter is dated June. They took a land route like the one that is described by the Zacharias Chronicle. In fact, it must have been the same route, from Constantinople through Edirne and Haskovo, because that was the major road from Tsarigrad into Bulgaria.
But can we be sure this last letter describes Bulgaria?
We cannot be absolutely certain. However, I believe it is very probable. If they traveled from Tsarigrad, Constantinople, into a country where monasteries and churches were being burned in the late 15th century, it is very likely that this was Bulgaria. Also, your letter from Istanbul states that they intend to go to Bulgaria.
There is an interesting line in here. Could you read that again? That the sign in the monastery they sought was a monster equal to a saint. What do you think this meant?
I looked quickly at Stoichev. This line had struck me, too. He sighed.
It might refer to a fresco or an icon that was in the monastery, in Sviatogorgi, if that was indeed their destination. It is difficult to imagine what such an image might have been. We must keep it in our minds, however, since Brother Kirill names it as the sign that will tell them they have come to the right place.
I was still wrestling with my disappointment. I realize now that I had expected these letters in their faded binding to hold the final key to our search, or at least to shed some light on the maps I still hope to use.
There is a larger issue that is very strange. The letter from Istanbul says that the treasure they seek, perhaps a holy relic from Tsarigrad, is in a particular monastery in Bulgaria, and that is why they must go there.
Why would a holy relic have been smuggled out of Constantinople in 1477? The city had been Ottoman since 1453, and most of its relics were destroyed in the invasion. Why did the monastery of Panakrantos send a remaining relic into Bulgaria 24 years later, and why was that the particular relic these monks had gone to Constantinople to find?
It must have been a holy object with political power for the Ottomans, as well as a spiritual treasure for the monks of Snagov.
A book, perhaps?
Helen was frowning, tapping her cheek with her pen. Yes, what if it was a book that contained some information the Ottomans wanted and the monks needed? Ranoff across the table suddenly gave me a hard look. Stoichev nodded slowly, but I remembered after a second that this meant disagreement. Books of that period did not usually contain political information. They were religious texts, copied many times for use in the monasteries. Helen's eyes were wide with thought.
Just a minute. Wait. It must have been something connected with Snagov's needs, or the Order of the Dragon, or maybe the wake for Vlad Dracula. Remember the chronicle? The abbot wanted Dracula buried somewhere else.
True. He wanted to send his body to Tsarigrad, even at the risk of the lives of his monks.
Yes. I think I was about to say something else, to meander down some other path of inquiry, but suddenly Helen turned to me and shook my arm. What? But by then she had fully recovered herself, without looking at either me or Ranulf.
Nothing.
I wished to God he would get up and go outside to smoke, or get tired of the conversation so that Helen could speak up freely. Stoichev glanced at her keenly, and after a moment he began to explain in a droning voice how medieval manuscripts were made and copied. I was puzzled about why he was going on at such length, although what he said held considerable interest for me. Fortunately, I stayed quiet during his disquisition, for eventually Ranulf actually began to yawn. Finally, he stood up and made his way out of the library, digging a pack of cigarettes out of his jacket pocket. As soon as he was gone, Helen seized my arm again. Stoichev watched her intently. Her face was so strange that I caught her around the shoulders, thinking she might faint.
Paul, his head. Don't you see? Dracula went back to Constantinople to get his head.
Stoichev made a little choked sound, but too late. At that moment, glancing around, I saw Brother Ruman's angular face around the edge of a bookshelf. He had come silently back into the room from the outer chamber, and although his back was to us while he put something away, it was a listening back. After a moment, he went quietly out again, and we all sat silent. Helen and I glanced helplessly at each other, and I got up to check the depths of the room. The man was gone, but it would probably be a matter of a short time before someone else, Ranulf, for example, heard about Helen's exclamation. And what use might Ranulf make of that information? Few moments in my years of research, writing, and thought have prompted for me such a sudden access of clarity as that moment when Helen spoke her guess aloud in the library at Rila. Vlad Dracula had returned to Constantinople for his head, or rather, the abbot of Snagov had sent his body there to be reunited with it. Had Dracula requested this ahead of time, knowing the bounty placed on his famous head in his lifetime, knowing the Sultan's penchant for displaying the heads of his enemies to the populace? Or had the abbot taken this mission upon himself, not wanting the headless body of his possibly heretical or dangerous sponsor to remain at Snagov? As soon as we were certain Brother Ruman had left, Stoichev spoke.
Yes, it is quite possible, but we simply cannot know the truth about this, although I think Miss Rossi's guess is a very good one. His head was the most likely object they could have sought in Tsarigrad. There is a good theological reason, too, for their having done so. Our orthodox beliefs state that as far as possible, the body must be whole in death. We do not practice cremation, for example, because on the Day of Judgment, we will be resurrected in our bodies.
What about the saints and all their relics scattered everywhere? How are they going to be resurrected whole? Not to mention that I saw five of St. Francis's hands in Italy a few years ago.
The saints have special privileges. But Vlad Dracula, although he was an excellent Turk killer, was certainly not a saint. In fact, Eupraxios was quite worried about his immortal soul, at least according to Stefan's tale.
Or about his immortal body.
So maybe the monks of Panacrantos took his head to give it proper burial, at the risk of their lives. And the Janissaries noticed the theft and began searching, so the abbot sent it out of Istanbul rather than bury it there. Maybe there were pilgrims going to Bulgaria from time to time. I glanced at Stoichev for confirmation. And they sent it for burial at, well, at Sveti Georgi or some other Bulgarian monastery where they had connections. And then the monks from Snagov arrived, but too late to reunite the body with the head. The abbot of Panacrantos heard about it and spoke with them, and the Snagov monks decided to complete their mission by following with the body. Besides, they had to get the hell out of there before the Janissaries got interested in them, too.
Very good for speculation. As I said, we cannot know for certain because these are events at which our documents only hint. But you have made a convincing picture of them. We will get you away from the Dutch merchants eventually.
I felt myself flush, partly from pleasure and partly from chagrin, but his smile was genial. Helen picked up the possible story.
And then the Ottoman network was put on guard by the presence and departure of the Snug of Monks. And maybe they searched the monasteries and discovered the monks had stayed at St. Irina, and they sent news of the monks' journey to the officials along their route. Perhaps to Edirne, and then to Haskovo. Haskovo was the first large Bulgarian town the monks entered, and that is where they were, what is the term, detained.
Yes. The Ottoman officials tortured two of them for information. But those two brave monks said nothing. And the officials searched the wagon and found only food. But this leaves a question. Why did the Ottoman soldiers not find the body?
Maybe they weren't looking for a body. Maybe they were still looking for the head. If the Janissaries had learned very little in Istanbul about the whole thing, they might have thought that the Snagov monks were the transporters of the head. The Chronicle of Zacharias said that the Ottomans were angry when they opened some bundles and found only food. The body could have been hidden in the woods nearby if the monks had some warning of the search.
Or perhaps they constructed the wagon so that there was a special place to hide it.
But a corpse would have stunk. She gave me her quizzical, charming smile.
That depends on what you believe.
What I believe?
Yes. You see, a body that is at risk for becoming undead, or is already undead, does not decay, or it decomposes more slowly. If villagers in Eastern Europe suspected vampirism, they would dig up corpses to check for decomposition, and ritually destroy those that were not decaying properly. It is still done sometimes, even now.
A peculiar activity. I have heard of it even in Bulgaria, although of course it is illegal now. The church always discouraged the desecration of graves, and now our government discourages all superstitions, as well as it can.
Is it any stranger than hoping for bodily resurrection?
Helen almost shrugged, but she smiled at Stoichev, and he too was charmed.
Madam, we have very different interpretations of our heritage, but I salute your quickness of mind. And now, my friend, I would like some time to study your maps. It has occurred to me that there are materials in this library that may be of assistance in reading them. Give me an hour. What I do now will be dull for you and slow for me to explain.
Ranoff had just come in again, restlessly, and stood looking around the room. I hoped he hadn't caught the mention of our maps. Stoichev cleared his throat. He glanced very slightly toward Ranoff.
Perhaps you would like to go into the church and see its beauty.
Helen immediately got up and went to Ranoff to engage him in some slight complication, while I fished discreetly in my briefcase and pulled out my file of copies of the maps. When I saw the eagerness with which Stoichev took them, my heart leapt with hope. Unfortunately, Ranoff seemed more interested in hovering over Stoichev's work and conferring with the librarian than in following us. The librarian stood silent, studying me closely. Ranoff smiled.
Would you help us find some dinner?
Are you hungry? It is not yet time for the meal here, which is supper at 6 o'clock. We will wait for that.
He turned his back on us and began to study a shelf of leather-bound volumes, and that was that. Helen followed me to the door and squeezed my hand.
Shall we go for a walk?
Helen took my arm. The sun was still brilliant in the courtyard and hot when we left the shadow of the immense monastery walls and galleries. Looking up, I could see the forested slopes around the monastery and the vertical rock peaks above them. Far overhead, an eagle banked and wheeled. Let's climb up the mountain there and get a view. The path up the mountain wound through dense forest that shielded us from the afternoon heat, almost as well as the church had. It was so good to be free of Ranoff that for a few minutes I simply swung Helen's hand back and forth as we walked. Do you think it was hard for him to choose between us and Stoichev?
Oh, no. He certainly has someone else following us. We will encounter whoever it is after a while, especially if we are gone more than half an hour.
We stopped to rest for a few minutes on a fallen tree near the road. I've been thinking about why they let us come into Bulgaria. Even here, out in the woods, I was lowering my voice. It seems to me that if they aren't stopping us from finding whatever we're looking for, which they could do so easily, It's because they want us to find it. Helen fanned my face with her hand.
Good, Sherlock. You are learning a great deal.
So, let's say they actually know or suspect what we're looking for. Why would they think it was valuable or even possible that Vlad Dracula is undead?
Think. What would be more powerful to science than the discovery that the dead can be brought to life, or to undeath in any case? Especially to the East Bloc, with its great leaders embalmed in their own tombs.
Then we have all the more reason to destroy Dracula. I could feel the perspiration break out on my forehead. Helen nodded.
The strange thing, you know, is that Stalin openly admired Ivan the Terrible. Two leaders who were willing to crush and kill their own people, to do anything necessary, in order to consolidate their power. And whom do you think Ivan the Terrible admired?
I felt the blood draining from my heart. You told me there were many Russian tales about Dracula.
Yes, exactly.
I stared at her. She was scraping a soft place on the log with her fingernail.
Can you imagine a world in which Stalin could live for 500 years? Or perhaps forever?
I found myself clenching my fists. Do you think we can find a medieval grave without leading anyone else to it?
It will be very difficult. Perhaps impossible. I am certain they have people watching us everywhere.
At this moment, a man came around the bend in the path. I was so startled by his sudden appearance that I almost swore aloud. But he was a simple-looking person, roughly dressed and with a bundle of branches on his shoulder, and he waved a hand to us in greeting and passed on. I looked at Helen.
You see?
Partway up the mountain, we found an outcropping of rock. The steep, wooded valley lay directly below us, almost filled by the walls and red roofs of the monastery. I could see clearly now the enormous size of the complex. It formed an angular shell around the church, whose domes glowed in the afternoon light. You can tell from up here how well fortified the place was. Imagine how often enemies must have looked down on it like this.
Or pilgrims. For them it would have been a spiritual destination, not a military challenge.
She leaned back against a tree trunk, smoothing her skirt. She had dropped her handbag, taken off her hat, rolled up the sleeves of her pale blouse for relief from the heat. Fine perspiration stood out on her forehead and cheeks. Her face wore the expression I loved best. She was lost in thought, gazing inward and outward at the same time, her eyes wide and intent, her jaw firm. Her harsh beauty sent a pang through me, not of mere physical longing, but of something akin to awe at her completeness. She was untouchable, mine but lost to me. Helen, I hadn't meant to speak, but I couldn't stop myself. I'd like to ask you something. She nodded, her eyes and thoughts still on the tremendous sanctuary below us. Helen, will you marry me? She turned slowly in my direction, and I wondered if I was seeing astonishment, amusement, or pleasure on her face.
Paul, how long have we known each other?
23 days.
Do you think you know me?
Not at all.
Do you think I know you?
I'm not sure.
We have so little experience of each other. We come from completely different worlds.
She smiled this time, as if to take some of the sting out of her words.
Besides, I have always thought I would not get married. I am not the sort who marries. And what about this?
She touched the scar on her neck.
Would you marry a woman who has been marked by hell?
I would protect you from any hell that could ever come near you. Her look was hard and direct.
Would that not be a burden? And how could we have children, knowing they might be affected somehow by this contamination?
It was hard for me to speak through the burning in my throat. Then, your answer is no, or shall I just ask you again another time? Her hand, I couldn't imagine doing without that hand, with its square-tipped fingernails and soft skin over hard bone, closed over mine, and I thought fleetingly that I didn't have a ring to put on it. Helen glanced gravely at me.
The answer is that, of course, I will marry you.
Barley stood beside me in my father's hotel.